Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
If you want to know what's going on in a given part of the economy, you keep an eye on companies in that part of the economy. Take housing. Last quarter, the CEO of the big home builder Toll Brothers said he thought we'd hit bottom. Just like that, stocks in everything from construction companies to mortgage brokers shot up. Today, Toll Brothers said it's not quite the bottom for builders yet. As for mortgage companies, it's even worse. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Cargill. Collaborate, create, succeed. This is how Cargill works with customers to bring about ideas for nourishing the world.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's great to have you here on this Thursday. Today's the 8th of February, and I told you about Toll Brothers so I could tell you this. The British banking giant HSBC has announced it's facing bad debt charges of more than $10 billion. That's about 20% higher than what analysts were expecting, and it's never nice to surprise analysts like that. HSBC said it's been left holding the bag because mortgage holders here in the United States aren't making their payments. Marketplace's Elisa Roth reports now from New York that HSBC is not the only one in trouble.
Back when interest rates were low and the housing market was hot, all kinds of people bought homes. Banks and other lenders offered mortgages even to people with very little income or lousy credit. Now the lenders are having a hard time because borrowers aren't paying them back.
This is basic banking.
Karen Shaw Petru heads the research firm Federal Financial Analytics. She says this about the banks.
People got so caught up in elaborate models and highly quantitative analytics that they forgot very simple things like ability to repay.
She says creative financing worked fine for a while. If the payments got to be too much, homeowners could always sell the house and pay back the lender. As home prices fall, though, it can be hard to get all that money out of a property. The result has been more defaults on mortgages and more foreclosures on houses. James Ballantyne is with the American Bankers Association. He says one answer is more monitoring. Banks need to track their customers better, making sure they're keeping up with payments, but also of their own businesses. Things like
the possibility whenever you make a loan that is subprime, you have to make sure that you have adequate assets in house to cover any defaults.
Ballantyne says there's likely to be more shaking out of the mortgage business, especially in the subprime market. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
The auto industry is another part of the economy that's in trouble. Detroit has spent most of the past year and a half trying to lure buyers with deep discounts and 0% financing. Toyota, meanwhile, has been going gangbusters with its smaller, more economical cars, which is why today's news about the Prius is surprising. Starting this month, the Japanese automaker is offering no-interest loans and other incentives to boost sales of those boxy gas electric hybrids. Quite a turnaround, considering just last year, Prius fans were waiting months for delivery or paying premiums to get their hands on one. Sarah Gardner reports from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk.
The news must be painful for all those drivers who paid top dollar just to get a used Prius. Toyota and some other hybrid dealers are now shouting, come and get them. Mark McCready at CarsDirect.com says he's surprised at how low Toyota's willing to go to sell a Prius.
You're seeing 0% financing for 24 months and 2.9% for 36 months. If you think of where current interest rates are, which are in the upper sixes, that's a pretty big buy down for Toyota.
So what happened? Gas prices, for one, they're down about 27% from that $3 high last summer. The federal tax credit on hybrids is on its way out, and carmakers may be close to exhausting the market of eco-driven buyers, says auto consultant Joe Philippi.
Once you get past the early adopters, then you got to go out and actually sell these things, along with the fact that Toyota is boosting capacity for the Prius by a fairly substantial amount.
Toyota aims to rev up Prius sales 50% this year. The automaker hopes the incentives will help them reach that goal. And one other. It wants to reshape the Prius's image as a vehicle for all Americans, not just tree-hugging, latte-sipping coasters. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
As long as we're talking about the environment, let's move on to something simple, like the Kyoto Protocol's carbon trading scheme. Okay, Not so simple, but here's the idea. Let industrialized countries buy the right to pollute by paying for greenhouse gas reductions in developing countries that can't afford to pay for those reductions themselves. A report out today in the journal Nature says that market solution is actually wasting billions of dollars. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Sam Eaton has that story.
The study found that the largest volume of greenhouse gas reductions on the global carbon market have come from a small number of factories in China and India that make air conditioners and refrigerators. That process emits a greenhouse gas known as HFC-23. It's so potent that the gas's effect on global warming is about 12,000 times that of carbon dioxide. That potency makes any reductions in HFC-23 emissions extremely valuable on the global carbon market. And because it's so cheap to fix, only about a couple million dollars a pop, the profit margins for the Chinese and Indian factories are huge. The report's author, Michael Wara, says that's distorting the entire carbon market.
What that's doing is funneling all of the money that the developed world is putting into lowering carbon emissions in the developing world into this one industry. And my main finding is that that's probably not the best way to be spending our money.
Wara says industrialized nations have spent billions of dollars buying up carbon credits for these projects, even though the actual cost of upgrading the factories was a mere fraction of that. He says that leaves less money to address major challenges to the world's climate, like moving China away from coal-fired power plants. China is expected to overtake the U.S. as the world's number one greenhouse gas emitter by 2009. But carbon market expert Mark Trexler says blaming Kyoto for the loophole isn't fair.
Kyoto was intended to be a much broader spectrum. So, I mean, the U.S. was supposed to be part of Kyoto, and that would have meant a lot more demand for reductions, which would have moved us up past a lot of this low-hanging fruit.
Trexler says until the U.S. joins the Kyoto Club, the impact of the global carbon market will be symbolic at best. In Los Angeles, I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace.
There's really no way to get into this next story other than to say you'd think companies spending $2.6 million for a 30-second television ad would have had more common sense. 4 days after the Super Bowl, advertisers are backing away from their ads faster than you can say Peyton Manning. Master Foods, which makes Snickers candy bars, and General Motors are among some of the firms being criticized for spots that critics call homophobic, violent, or likely to endanger people feeling suicidal. Pat Loeb takes it from there.
The GM ad features a perfection-obsessed robot considering suicide after dropping a bolt on the assembly line. GM spokeswoman Rindy Carney says the carmaker didn't mean to offend anyone, but...
Advertising during the Super Bowl brings instant critiques, both positive and negative. We have no plans to change the spot.
We would hope they'd reconsider.
Bob Gabbia is president of the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. He says the ad was at the least insensitive, but with 93 million people watching, it could even be dangerous.
People who are vulnerable can be swayed by these kinds of messages.
And that's the point. Advertisers will pay $2.5 million for 30 seconds with an audience that large. That's also why their ads can produce such an outcry. It's not just GM. Anheuser-Busch had to apologize for a violent streak to its ads, and Snickers had to pull a whole campaign built around a commercial deemed homophobic, where two men touch lips while eating the same candy bar.
I think we just accidentally kissed.
Quick, do something manly.
Neil Giuliano is president of the Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation. He says the Snickers ad agency called them in early January and asked them to review the ad. He never received it. The ensuing storm has brought an extra week of publicity for the ad, though it hasn't all been good. In Los Angeles, I'm Pat Loeb for Marketplace.
If you happen to have missed them somehow, we've got those ads on our website. It's marketplace.org. That report from HSBC about its bad debts beat back some good news about retail sales today, and investors reacted accordingly. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. When the subject is negotiations with North Korea, having the Secretary of State say she is cautiously optimistic is practically a rave review. Condoleezza Rice weighed in today on the six-party talks that are going on in Beijing. The North Koreans say they're willing to talk about their nuclear program, and the U.S. is hinting it might back off a key financial sanction against them. Marketplace's Scott Tong's been following the talks from Shanghai for us. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Kai. How are you?
I'm all right. Listen, remind us, what is at the root of this, the U.S. banking sanctions, and then what seems to be happening at the talks?
Well, there's a bank in Macau at the center of all this called Banco Delta Asia. And the U.S. has long suspected that the North Korean leaders have been using this bank to finance a bunch of underground economic activity, money laundering, printing counterfeit currency, etc. So a year and a half ago, Washington blacklisted this bank, which got embarrassed. And then the bank froze the assets of these leaders in Pyongyang, about $24 million worth of assets. And what happened was a lot of banks in Asia suddenly saw this and got scared off. And they decided, you know, we're not going to do any business with North Korea either. What's happening at these talks is there are rumors that the United States may ease some of these banking sanctions as part of the negotiations. I spoke today to Professor Brian Bridges at Lingnan University in Hong Kong. He says the whole idea here is for the U.S. to rope the North Koreans back to the table.
Probably the Americans may be willing to declare part of that funding clean, as it were, or unfreeze it as part of a package of concessions, provided, of course, that something comes from the North Korean side in return.
So what that would involve is North Korea shutting down its weapons program and allowing United Nations inspectors back in. And you may recall that in 2002, they got kicked out of North Korea.
Now, the difference, of course, between this time and last time is that in the interim, North Korea has become a nuclear power. So what price do you suppose the U.S. is willing to pay to get the North to give all this up?
Well, the outlines of the price tag, as it were, from the United States point of view, are familiar. There's a lot of talk of going back and implementing a deal that was cut in 2005. The U.S. would provide energy assistance and other economic assistance, perhaps take North Korea off the list of state sponsors of terrorism, and lift these bank sanctions we talked about, and work to get other U.N. economic sanctions lifted. Now, to get all this going, each side has to make kind of an initial commitment in these talks. And one former U.S. official said Washington may be willing to take a smaller down payment. Professor Bridges in Hong Kong says that's the political calculation that's facing U.S. diplomats.
The question, I guess, is whether they're willing to sort of compromise in the short run, now that North Korea is effectively a nuclear power, how far they're willing to go in terms of saying, well, that's something we want to achieve further down the line, but for the moment, let's try and do it step by step.
So the question is, why would the U.S. take a smaller down payment? Well, some say the Bush administration needs a political victory somewhere in the world. Others say, as you've mentioned, that North Korea is now considered a nuclear power, partial nuclear power. And others say the time is ripe inside of North Korea, that there's a debate going on there whether they should really shift gears economically and pursue China-style market reforms. And we all know how much buying and selling is going on here in China.
We do indeed. Marketplace is Scott Tong in China. Thank you, Scott.
Thanks, Kai.
Wall Street has earnings season when companies report quarterly profits. Investors have something called proxy season. It runs roughly between March and June, when most public companies hold their annual meetings, and when shareholders get to vote on the board of directors and corporate governance proposals. This year, there will be something different on some of those ballots. Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
When Robert Nardelli abruptly resigned as CEO of Home Depot last month, Richard Furlato claimed some of the credit. He's director of pension policy for the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. Furlato says it all began last May at Home Depot's annual shareholder meeting.
We showed up asking to have a discussion with the board of directors about Bob Nardelli's pay package, which we thought was huge and undeserved and was a waste of shareholders' money. It turns out that the board never showed up.
Nardelli did. But he wouldn't answer any questions about his pay. At the time, some $150 million. Furlato says the resulting outcry helped end Nardelli's career at Home Depot, and it inspired a surge of shareholder activism. This proxy season, Furlato says at least 75 companies will face so-called say-on-pay resolutions. These would give shareholders a chance to vote on executive compensation packages. The votes are non-binding, meaning directors don't have to listen. But Furlato says shareholders in Britain have had such a vote for several years.
And it's been very successful in promoting better dialogue between corporate managers and the share owners.
Shareholder activists have been fretting about runaway CEO pay for years, but cases like Nardelli's and the ongoing stock options backdating scandal have helped push the issue into the mainstream. Kent Hughes is managing director at Egan Jones Proxy Services. The company advises institutional investors. He says mutual funds and endowments used to vote pretty much in lockstep with management, but clients' growing concern about executive pay prompted his company to change its voting guidelines recently. Hughes says his firm will now recommend that investors protest outrageous pay packages by withholding votes for board members.
This is a case-by-case thing we're talking about, but we might be willing in certain egregious cases not only to withhold on certain members of the compensation committee, but on members of the entire board or the chief executive officer.
Another factor could make this an especially feisty proxy season. Ralph Ward edits the newsletter Boardroom Insider. He says new SEC rules will force companies to disclose their executives' total compensation, salary, stock options, severance, everything.
Maybe individually those elements looked okay. Now the board has to look at them all added up in one place, and a number of boards are having a holy cow moment about that. They hadn't realized exactly how much they'd put the company on the hook for.
None of these say-on-pay resolutions has passed yet, but sponsors say the few that came up last year won an average 40% of the vote. Corporate managers at AT&T and Verizon are concerned enough to have asked the SEC to let them drop the proposals from their ballots this year. The climate is making David Nozel's job a bit harder. He recruits CEOs and other executives on behalf of employers. He says job candidates now review their pay packages much more carefully or dodge the scrutiny altogether.
We've seen a shift in leadership from public companies to private companies, meaning world-class CEOs have a higher level of interest in going into the private company model versus being in the line of fire in a public company.
So how do you lure those world-class CEOs back to the public sector? You guessed it, higher pay. But if shareholders have their way, executives will have to fight for it. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Coming up, new rules for the corporate road in Europe.
It could actually drive companies away from London in particular, rather as Sarbanes-Oxley drove companies away from New York.
But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials knocked off 29 points today, about 0.2% to finish at 12,637. The Nasdaq lost a point, closing basically flat at 2488. The S&P 500 also nicked off a point, or 0.1%, to end at 1448. Home builders felt the pinch. Toll Brothers fell 3% today after that warning I mentioned. D.R. Horton deconstructed 3.3%. Lennar sawed off 2.75%. KB Home was just behind Lennar with a loss of 2.25%. Mortgage lenders didn't have a day at the beach either. Countrywide Financial and Washington Mutual each kissed about 2.5% goodbye. Citigroup soured almost 1%. J.P. Morgan left 0.5% at the picnic table. An Eastman Kodak announcement about cutting 3,000 more jobs didn't go over too well. The company said it expects charges of more than $3 billion related to its restructuring. Shareholders restructured Kodak down about 2.5% today. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note ticked down to 4.73%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Since 1937, managing money with a focus on consistent results over the long term. Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Want to hear something on Marketplace again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and additional special features, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just head over to marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Friday. In Washington, Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff testifies about President Bush's budget proposal before the House Homeland Security Committee. The winners of the 2007 World Press Photo Contest are announced in Amsterdam. 78,083 images were submitted for consideration. And the Mardi Gras parade season opens in New Orleans. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. The clothing retailer Eddie Bauer said today its shareholders have voted down a proposed private equity buyout. That makes Eddie Bauer one of the few public companies lately to have rejected a big pile of private cash. Yesterday, we told you the Blackstone Group has sealed the deal to buy Equity Office Properties for $23 billion. Blackstone's now the country's biggest commercial office space landlord. It's also the latest target for critics of private equity deals. They say CEOs of publicly held companies are selling out without keeping shareholders in mind, that all private equity firms want to do is strip their purchases down and sell them off. Commentator Matthew Bishop sees it a different way.
Private equity is one of the best things happening in business today. Far from asset stripping, private equity firms mostly do a much better job of building strong companies than the alternative, the public equity you see in action every day on the New York Stock Exchange. Public equity suffers from that paralyzing disease, short-termism. Share traders are obsessed with every piece of news about a company. Public company bosses live in terror of doing anything that will cause the share price to drop. Boards are trigger-happy, firing CEOs in record numbers. But bosses at private firms can manage for the long term. They don't have to worry about the short-term ups and downs of the stock market. That means they can take the sort of tough, short-term profit-reducing decisions that tend to scare public shareholders. Decisions like closing underperforming businesses or investing heavily in new factories and products. Private equity is also better than public equity at holding bosses to account. True, bosses often get much better paid by private equity than by public companies, which, as we all know, pay them well enough. That does create a conflict of interest when the boss of a public company considers selling the firm to private equity. But if shareholders in public companies don't like the price offered for their shares by private equity, they don't have to sell. Unlike public companies, private equity only pays bosses well when they perform well, not when they fail. Building better companies is creating vast quantities of wealth for those who invest in private equity. The biggest investors in private equity by far are public pension funds. That's right, that's your retirement nest egg. It's time to stop criticizing private equity. As they say, love it or leave it.
Matthew Bishop's the chief business writer at The Economist magazine. Take a second to send us your thoughts. Our website is marketplace.org. New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg was in London earlier this week. The mayor and other New York politicians are worried the Big Apple's losing its edge in global finance. They say companies are taking their business overseas rather than deal with strict new accountability laws here in the States. Laws like Sarbanes-Oxley that went into effect after the Enron debacle. London has won a lot of the money that's moved out of New York, so businesses there aren't too excited about a possible European version of Sarbanes-Oxley. From London Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
In some ways, London is now the world's top financial center. There are more foreign banks here than in any other city, including New York. The London stock market has the most foreign listings, but London could lose that global lead if a new European law comes into force unamended, says economist Andrew Hilton.
It could actually drive companies away from London in particular, rather as Sarbanes-Oxley drove companies away from New York. This piece of legislation could have unintended adverse consequences for London in particular.
The new law is the 8th Company Law Directive on Statutory Audit. Sounds boring, but it was prompted partly by one of the most colourful villains ever to appear on Britain's financial scene.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome. Tonight, you are all the guests of Robert Maxwell.
Maxwell, the subject of this comic opera, was a media magnate who plundered several large companies and then apparently jumped off his yacht and drowned in the Mediterranean. This and other scandals led to calls for a tightening up of auditing rules. The eighth directive is the long-delayed result. But, says Damien Rees, financial editor of the Daily Telegraph, there's a problem.
What it basically does is put a lot more onerous rules and regulations on foreign companies that want to list on either the London stock market or Paris or any of those big European bourses.
As the directive stands, a foreign company wanting to list in Europe may need to have their auditor vetted and recognised by a European regulator, and perhaps have an additional audit. A bureaucratic nightmare, says Rees, and just when the US is waking up to the error of its ways.
The mood music there is very much for beginning to roll back the tide of regulation. And Sarbanes-Oxley is obviously under intense scrutiny in terms of it being reformed and made somewhat more realistic.
The London Stock Exchange is less worried about the Eighth Directive. Spokesman Adam Kinsley says there's a new consultation process. The directive will be amended. The regulation will be loosened. He says Europe is learning from America's mistake.
We've seen what can happen with unintended consequences of legislation, and that's understood all too well in Europe. So we're very keen not to fall into the same traps.
Well, Britain certainly is. Of all the EU countries, it has by far the most to lose. Most of the other member states don't have international financial centres. And say the cynics, those that do, like Paris and Frankfurt, are rather jealous of London and might rather enjoy seeing the Brits knocked off their perch. Europe, they say, could still saddle itself with its own homegrown Sarbanes-Oxley. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals at Vanguard.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, back on the topic of executive pay that Amy Scott was telling us about, U.S. Commerce Secretary Carlos Gutierrez thinks the system that sets compensation packages is just fine. He told Reuters today there's no need for federal intervention. Companies can handle it. Exorbitant pay packages have been a touchy topic. President Bush complained about them recently. He urged corporate boards to do more to tie pay to performance. Gutierrez does know a little something about CEO pay. He used to be the chief executive at Kellogg, where in 2003, a year before he left the company, he made $7.4 million. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. After 2 days of doing nothing, today the Dow dropped 29 points, 0.2%. The Nasdaq lost a point. We'll call that flat. The S&P 500 fell a point, 0.1%. Our editors include John Buckley, Margaret Koval, Karen Lowe, Stacey Vanek Smith, and Lisa Tucker. Next time, splitting hairs on the Sabbath.
Define doing. It's a direct action. Well, what about indirect action? Cynical people who come in say, gee, that's great. The Almighty said keep Shabbat, and you guys are finding ways around it.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.